Welcome to the Pulteney Street Podcast. I'm your host, President Joyce Jacobson. My guest today is Lieutenant Colonel John Norvell from the class of 1966, who, along with his wife Bonnie, is the parent of two William Smith graduates, Amy from the class of 1999 and Melissa from the class of 2002. A decorated air combat veteran of the Vietnam War, Colonel Norvell served in the U.S. Air Force from 1966 to 1989. He is a master navigator and weapons system officer with more than 1,000 hours in the F-4 Phantom II and 400 hours as an instructor navigator in other jet aircraft. In 1973, as a member of the 13th Tactical Fighter Squadron, he flew the last unofficial F-4 fighter bombing mission of the Vietnam War to launch from Udorn Royal Thai Air Force Base. Colonel Norvell went on to serve as Assistant Professor of History at the Air Force Academy and later as Alumni Director at HWS. He holds an MA from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. And as a student at Hobart, he studied American history and was a member of the Druids Canterbury Club and the Echo and Pine yearbook staff. John Norvell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, President Jacobson. You know, it's a real pleasure to be here today and to be involved with this. And I did do my homework because I knew you were going to give me a test today.
Yes, it'll be an oral examination. So I always like to start with an origin question. And today I'll actually be asking you two. But here's the first one. When and where did your interest in service begin?
Well, I come from a really old American military family. I can trace ties to the military back to Colonial Williamsburg, where my sixth great-grandfather was a captain in the militia. And my third great-grandfather was a lieutenant in the Revolutionary War. My second great-grandfather fought in the Maryland militia in the War of 1812, and actually had an interesting story. He was in the Battle of Bladensburg, and Bladensburg is just outside Washington. And Bladensburg was a real disaster for the Americans, and they basically ran from the battlefield. And on the way back to meet his wife in Washington, he and his brother-in-law and his wife took shelter in the White House just before the British burned it, and wrote about it in their autobiographies. My great-grandfather was a Marine in the halls of Montezuma and later a colonel in the Civil War. And he and five of his brothers fought in the Battle of Gettysburg. And my dad was a career Army officer. So I've been kind of steeped in military history within my family almost from day one. But these are all guys that fought in the Army, and I wanted to fly. Mm. And so I came to Hobart. And I really had an interest in flying because growing up in the 1950s, the Air Force really was in a prominent role in American life, and it was really a lot of news about the Air Force. And concurrently, the astronauts began to take a lot of the public press. I never really had the desire to be an astronaut. I didn't think that I had the technical skills to do that. Even from high school, I knew my math was not that great. But I did want to fly. So I came to Hobart because it had an ROTC program. And that's why I ended up in the military.
Well, one of the reasons I'm interviewing you right now, John, though I've actually wanted to talk to you for quite a while, is that you have just published a book recently called Fighter Gator. And one of the things that the book is particularly about is about the F-4 Phantom II. So could you describe the F-4 Phantom II and what it was like to fly in Vietnam?
The Phantom was really a very complicated airplane. It required two people to fly it. It was initially a Navy fighter, then the Air Force decided to do it. And it became the primary fighter used in the Vietnam War. More Phantoms were shot down than any other airplane. So in addition to being a fighter, it was kind of an exciting plane to fly in because there was a good chance that you might get shot down in combat because you were in the midst of what was going on. I was in the back seat of the Phantom. It required some technical skills, and you might find that interesting that I, a history major from Hobart and Syracuse University, ended up doing a highly technical job in the backseat of an airplane in Vietnam. But I found when I was teaching at the Air Force Academy and teaching at the NAV school that people who had liberal arts educations made really good navigators because they were able to process a lot of different types of information and use it in a very logical way. And I think being a history major and having done honors work at Hobart put me in a position to do well. I didn't do math very well, but I did do simple arithmetic. And that's what you need to do to be a navigator, simple arithmetic. It was a big plane. It was about 56 feet long. It was 38 feet wide. It weighed almost 60,000 pounds during takeoff. And as I said, in those pre-high-tech days, it really did require two people to fly it. A pilot who did all the flying skills and my job in the back, which was to run all the technical equipment, run the radar, direct the pilot in where he was supposed to go. And really, we were a team from takeoff till landing. It was a team effort.
Well, that seems like a very positive part. But in your book, Fighter Gator, you also describe some less positive things, including how you prepared for combat and for potentially becoming a prisoner of war. Can you describe that preparation process and what you learned?
Well, it was before I even got to the POW part, there were 2 years of very intensive flight training that I went through. And interestingly enough, in the first year when I was in navigator training, I had a Hobart connection. I always found that these Hobart connections popped up at interesting moments in my life. I went through almost a year of navigator training, which required flight checks periodically. And on my final check, which would pass me and give me my wings, my check guy, my navigator, was a Hobart grad, Bill Maroon, class of 63, who I knew at Hobart. Now, one might argue that there was no way I was going to fail that final flight check because of the fact that Bill was my instructor on that flight. But it was just a funny thing to walk into that airplane and see somebody who I'd known in Geneva, New York, who was going to give me my final flight check. From there, I went to a year of training in the F-4. When I got done with that, it was time to go to survival training. And I went to basic survival first, part of which was the POW camp that you mentioned. But I also went through two other survival schools. I went through water survival, and I went through jungle survival, ultimately. The POW part of it probably was the most challenging because it was so very different from any other experience that I would say any American, unless you've been in a prison in the United States, would ever encounter. And it began by going through a very rough obstacle course, which wore me down, and then being put into a prisoner situation where you were literally for 3 days treated as if you were a prisoner in a POW camp. And a very, very demanding type of situation. But the thing I learned from it was that I had to be able to draw on resources I had within myself. And it gave me some skills to deal with that situation if I ever were shot down in Southeast Asia.
Yeah. Well, there is an old adage that war is long periods of boredom interrupted by shorter periods of sheer terror, which is actually how my son used to describe baseball, playing baseball also. So much is written about combat itself, but you had some particularly interesting encounters when not flying too, which you talked about in your book. Could you tell us a little bit about Eldridge in particular?
Well, I'm glad you asked about Eldridge because most squadrons had mascots. It was an old thing within flying squadrons to have a mascot. And it actually goes back to the first flying units in World War I, the first aero squadron, and even to the French, the Lafayette Escadrille, who had two lion cubs as mascots, whiskey and soda. And we even have a Hobart connection to that, too, that I found when I was working on this book of veteran stories that we're doing for the Bicentennial. One of the Hobart grads from the class of 1917 went to Europe and was flying with the Lafayette Escadrille, which was a flying unit that fought in World War I before Americans were allowed to fly. Before America went into the war, a lot of Americans went overseas and joined European units to fly against the Germans. So I thought that was kind of interesting that there was, another tie to somebody from Hobart and who was around these cubs, whiskey and soda. Eldridge was a Black Panther cub that we got in 1971. from a CIA pilot. I mean, this is a real, this could be just a story in and of itself. The CIA, of course, was flying all through Southeast Asia during this time, and this pilot picked up Eldridge in Malaysia when he was about 7 months old, brought him back. And since our unit's symbol was a Black Panther on our patch, he gave it to us, the 13th Tactical Fighter Squadron. And we raised Eldridge for 2 years, treated him just like the most prized house cat that you'd ever want to have. He was pampered. He was fed steaks every day. He was taken out and walked around the base. And he got to be quite a good sized cat. He was about 5 feet long, and he weighed over 100 pounds. He was a big, big animal, and he pretty much ruled the roost. Wherever Eldridge wanted to go, he went, and so we followed along with him. And it got to the point, though, he was getting too big. He was just too big. We had kept him in the various people's rooms at first, and then they decided to put him in the squadron lounge, which was sort of a good idea, but he tore up the couch. You couldn't leave him alone in a place like that. So they finally built an enclosure for him out of chicken, basically double chain link, chicken wire type enclosure, and kept him in there. And by the time I got there in 73, it was time that Eldridge had to leave. He was going to have to go to a zoo somewhere, which is interestingly enough what they did with the two cubs back at the Lafayette Escadrille when they got too big. They gave them to the Paris Zoo. Well, we didn't have a Paris Zoo to give him to, but we gave him to the Phoenix Zoo. Phoenix being the home of fighter pilots, almost every fighter pilot in the world had gone through Luke Air Force Base, which I went through in training outside of Phoenix. So Eldridge was there at Luke for the next 20 some years. He fathered six cubs, two of which survived. And I would say that probably every fighter pilot knew about him went and visited him when they were in the area. You might ask yourself, why did these squadrons keep pets like that? Any thoughts on that? Why do you think we would have a pet like that?
Well, I think it's a little bit of, interestingly, humanity also to have something you can care for and a sign of life.
Well, I would think also that's very true. And it was also maybe a way of a little bit of being at home. I mean, every kid's had a pet. And when you're in combat and you get back to the squadron and you see Eldridge there, you're kind of taken home in your mind. And being overseas in this kind of a setting is a very difficult situation, and these ties at home are very important, and Eldridge was a tie home. Skyler Van Horn, who's writing a story for our veterans book, talks about having a dog, Henry, in Vietnam that he had as a pet. And almost every GI that you run into encountered somebody that had a pet overseas in a combat zone, because like you said, it's a little bit of humanity, but it's also a tie up.
Yeah, I might have preferred something like a guinea pig or a dog to a 5-foot-long panther, though.
Well, some people had snakes and some people had iguanas and all other things. At least Eldridge was lovable.
Did you ever, could you pet him? Would he purr?
Oh, yeah, you could pet him. You could rub his stomach, just like a male house cat. He'd lie on his back and you could scratch his stomach. But he had his claws and you had to get out of the way fast, because like any male house cat, he would come at you with his claws kind of playing around. So I never saw him hurt anybody. But yeah, you move quickly.
Probably best he went away. Now, in a Finger Lakes Times op-ed that you wrote in 2020, you wrote about duty, honor, and country, and what it means to be a member of the U.S. Armed Forces. Could you reflect on the impact of your military service on your life and your worldview?
You know, it really did shape my outlook on life, those three words. And interestingly enough, that concept, while it's been around forever in the military, wasn't sort of vocalized until 1962, when I was a cadet at Hobart. That was when Douglas MacArthur gave his famous speech in Congress about the ethos of the military, and the three parts of it were duty, honor, and country. I tried to put it into words at the tail end of my book, because everything that I went through in the book illustrates that in some way. And I had dedicated the book to Ted Zhorak, who was my ROTC instructor at Hobart. Ted was killed in 1966, 3 days before we graduated, on a rescue mission over North Vietnam. He was an A-1 pilot, and his job was to help guide rescue forces for downed aircrew members. And so I tried to talk about it in the book, and I tried to define it in terms of how I had experienced it. And duty to me didn't mean just going to work. Duty to me meant dedication to something. And I found that to be the case when I was a NAV student. When I was not in NAV school for 4 years, to back up a little bit, when I tried to go on flying training after I was in graduate school at Syracuse, my vision had changed and I got stuck in a really bad job in Washington, D.C., a real dead-end job. Everybody's had a dead-end job. And I really pushed to get into flying training for 3 years and I got in. But while I was in that job, duty for me meant was just showing up for work. And I learned when I got into flying training that duty meant something entirely different. Duty meant being the best possible navigator student I could be. It meant dedication to doing something above and beyond myself, that I had to dedicate every single moment of my life to being a navigator student and achieving the goal of being a navigator. So it really meant hard work and dedication. And honor, the second part of that, those three words, meant more to me a sense of trust. It was a sense of being able to trust someone. If someone was honorable, I could trust them. If they weren't honorable, I really didn't want to have anything to do with them. And that's very important in combat. You have to be able to trust the person you're flying with. You have to be able to trust your commander. You have to be able to understand that he's telling you the truth, or the person you're flying with, that you put your life in their hands, is an honorable person that you can trust. And country, the last word, really is not just country. It's a sense of loyalty to something beyond yourself. And that's always the way I defined country, is being loyal to something beyond yourself. That could be your unit. It could be a friend. It could be a cause. If you go back and look at military history, the United States has always had a cause we fought for. And sometimes that's what people are loyal to, that particular cause. In the Civil War, particularly, people were loyal to the North because they wanted to restore the Union. They were loyal to the South because they thought it would give them states' rights to do whatever they wanted to do, and we know what they wanted to do. But it was beyond yourself. It was something bigger than you were, this idea of loyalty.
Oh, that's beautifully phrased, the way you go through those three parts. Speaking of countries, as we record this podcast, Russia has invaded the Ukraine, and the situation there does not seem to be abating. From your vantage point as a military historian and former professor of history at the Air Force Academy, do you have any insight you would like to share with our listeners on what is currently happening in Europe?
I would couch all of what I would say in terms of what's happened in the past. Obviously, as a historian, that's the way I would look at it. Mark Twain had a quote that's attributed to him, that history doesn't repeat itself, it often rhymes. And I think to understand what's going on, you have to understand that we're really seeing one of these rhyming situations. If you look at what's going on in Europe right now, it's very similar to the 1930s. It reminds me of that whole period when Hitler was being appeased. And over the 10-year period, the last 10 years, I think there was a certain naivete in looking at Putin and what he was doing and how to deal with him. And much like Chamberlain was naive about dealing with Hitler. But apart from that, I think you can also see in this what is happening right now, probably a good understanding of how it is to run a battle. And I go back even farther when I look at this. I look to the Battle of Gettysburg, because Gettysburg is a great example of leadership and of things going wrong and of what's happening really in the Ukraine right now. And I say that because you get all kinds of demonstrations of leadership. A couple of years ago, Chip Caprero and I taught a course on the Battle of Gettysburg as part of the Reader's College at Hobart and William Smith. So it gave me an opportunity to look at different leaders of the battle and to see how successful they were. Putin, I know you're going to get letters. I'm going to get letters. Putin reminds me a lot of Robert E. Lee. And I'll say this because Lee was a very strong leader of his forces, but Lee was very blind to what was going on in the battle. He was described as having his blood up, which meant he got so engrossed in the outcome of what he wanted to have happen in the battle, he wasn't really paying attention to where the battle was going. And I really think that's what's going on with Putin right now. He is so determined to win this battle in Ukraine that he's kind of blind to what is happening around him. He never anticipated the reaction that it would bring in the rest of the world. He didn't understand the logistics of fighting a war in another country, and he kind of has made some bad decisions that lead to that at Gettysburg too. So I think you can look to the past at some of these leaders and see different examples of how these things could go. But you can also look at military history, because almost every battle that's happened has had a plan, and obviously Putin had a plan for this. But there's a factor in war called the fog of war, which always comes into play. It doesn't matter how well you plan a battle, it never goes the way you think it's going to go. And in Europe particularly, we saw that in World War I, where all these major plans were put into place and it was going to guarantee a quick victory to the Germans or to the French, and that didn't happen. And things have happened that way in Russia right now. Everything has slowed down. It's almost, it's not quite a stalemate situation, but it's one level above a stalemate. I would assume, and it's not a good thing to make assumptions, but I would assume that sooner or later, Putin will win, because he will just continue to pound away on Ukraine until the country collapses. I mean, that's going to be his approach. And
I guess the question is how much of a victory that is, though, because it will lead to additional entanglement.
It's going to be a Pyrrhic victory at best. He'll prevail. He may put in a puppet regime, but the price is going to be awfully high. And I think the way things have been going from the United States and NATO has been very wise. They've been taking very cautious steps to take the necessary action that they have to. But like in World War I, any false moves could lead to much more disastrous consequences, and we don't want to go down that road.
I think that's the scary part.
Yes.
Flipping back to Hobart and William Smith, here's the second origin question. You mentioned about coming to ROTC here, but there are other places you might have gone also. So how did you first learn about Hobart?
Well, I had a lot of exposure to Hobart. I grew up about 60 miles away over near Oswego, so it was about an hour away from the campus. So I heard about Hobart a lot playing lacrosse. I mean, it was always in the Syracuse papers. So Hobart was in front of me. Secondly, my youngest sister was a cerebral palsy patient over near Mount Morris. When she was a child, when she was an infant on, she was in an institution. So my parents would, once a month, we would drive over to visit her, and we'd go through Geneva. So I was exposed to Hobart that way. I always went by the campus on 5 and 20. I could see it in the distance, although I didn't know that much about it. But the way I really learned about Hobart and William Smith was in 1961 on the GE College Bowl. I mean, I watched that every Sunday. I was not an athlete in high school. I mean, I was built like a fire plug, little short guy. I had vision problems, so I was never great at baseball, but I could knock the ball out of the park academically. And so I always like to watch the College Bowl and see if I could answer any of the questions, because it's like watching Jeopardy today. I mean, there are a large number of my friends from Hobart that watch Jeopardy all the time because they like to see if they can answer the questions based on our exposure to Western Civ. So I watched the College Bowl for 5 weeks in a row in 1961 in Hobart and Weem Smith. Every week they did really well, and they got down to that fifth session, and they beat Baylor, and they cleaned Baylor's clock. The final score was something like 245 to 160, and I was really impressed, and I thought to myself, wow, here's a place that can play championship lacrosse and has academics that's really, really out there. And that's the place I want to go. And after I interviewed and saw the campus, I knew that that was the place for me. I could see myself at Hobart. I really felt like I belonged at the colleges. So the rest is history, of course, as they say.
Well, your first year at Hobart was 60 years ago, and you've been closely connected to the colleges ever since. What do you see as that have been the most significant changes at Hobart and William Smith during that time?
Well, you know, I arrived at Hobart in the fall of 1962, as you said, 60 years ago. And I'll tell you, my arrival at Hobart and William Smith was pretty much my parents drove up. I had a cardboard suitcase in one hand, a portable typewriter in the other. I got out, my parents said goodbye, and they left. And I got handed an H book. And I began my time there. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because I had two daughters that went to William Smith. And I want to contrast that a little bit because their arrival at William Smith, both of them, was very, very different than when I arrived at Hobart in 1962. When they both arrived in the late 1990s, Amy arrived in 95, Melissa arrived in 99. We drove up in a caravan of cars. We unloaded a refrigerator, a TV, a computer, suitcases after suitcase, a cell phone. And when they got to William Smith, they were handed a copy of Our Bodies Ourselves. It was an entirely different world in many different ways. But yet it wasn't a different world. It was in many ways very much the same place that I went to. There was still a good sense of community that I could identify with. And it was really a place that they found the same sort of family of teachers and friends that I found in 1962. And then I came back to it again I was there for a third time, not only living it through my initial 62 experience and their 90s experience, I was the alumni director when they came. So I was experiencing the colleges again for a third time and sort of awakening my memories of the place. And when I would walk around the campus, there were ghosts that were hiding in different buildings that would come out and talk to me. I had a different experience again for the third time, but I found that it was a place that they felt very comfortable with. They were able to identify with their professors who helped them adjust to the colleges and succeed, just as I found the people that helped me. I had a very, very rough first year. I mean, I almost didn't have a second year as that rough. I had been really well in high school, but when I went to Hobart, I found that I was like a little fish in a big pond, and it took me a while to settle in. I just felt like all the other kids were a lot smarter than I was. And I had to find my place. And people like John Woody, who was the dean of freshmen at the time, and some of the other people that I dealt with as professors later on, helped me transition into where I needed to be. I started out as a chemistry major, quickly discovered that I couldn't do the mathematics that I required to be a chem major. And others helped me see that maybe history that I always got A's in high school was the way I needed to go. And I did very well in history. I ended up doing honors, and I got high honors in history when I graduated. But that was only because people guided me in the direction I needed to go. Just as my daughter, Amy, she was thinking about, I don't know really where she was planning to go. At one point, she talked about being a lawyer and doing all these other things. but she was really, really good at mathematics. I mean, that's fine to hard to believe since I wasn't, but her mother was. And her professor, Ann Oakes, who was a retired a professor emerita of mathematics, convinced her that maybe applied mathematics was where she needed to be. And now Amy's an actuary using her skills.
Perfect.
It was a perfect match. And she, even while she was at William Smith, she began taking her actuarial exams. So she had already completed two of them. I did well in history. I was able to parlay that into something else in the Air Force. And I used the skills I got at Hobart and William Smith to succeed when I was in my career. So I think that's pretty much part of the story. The other part of the story was the colleges became a much better place physically. You know, if you were to go there in 1962, as I did, the ambiance of the place was fluorescent lights and cinder block. I mean, that was pretty much what you saw in most of the newer buildings. There were some of the older buildings still around, the Blackwell Room and the old library, and some of the other places were kind of classy looking places, but it was very utilitarian. And the colleges got better over the years. When I came back as the alumni director, I was amazed at how much the facilities had changed. In fact, one of my jobs as alumni director was to kind of help people into this new world of Hobart William Smith, because they would come and they'd have no idea what any of these buildings were and where they were. And they would, you know, for the most part, they would associate with the dorms they lived in, or Cox Hall, or perhaps Medbury, or the chapel or something. But I had to kind of tell them where all the new places were. And there really were so many new facilities. It was really much more of a world-class facility. I got a world-class education when I was there in the 60s, but the facilities finally caught up with the education that you could receive at the colleges. So I think that's the kind of changes that occurred. And yet one more thing I'll share with you, because I was there in two interesting time periods. I was walking across the quad in November 22nd, 1963, when John Kennedy was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And it was a really traumatic experience. And we went through it. And I have written about that in the Finger Lakes Times, that the adults in charge were kind of making it up as they went along, because they really didn't know what to do. The professors and the head of the colleges, they really didn't know how to respond to this. It had nothing like this had ever happened. I was also there as the alumni director in 2001, on September 11th, when another very traumatic event occurred in American history. And we suddenly found ourselves, I who had been a student so long ago, as the adults in charge and dealing with a situation that we really didn't know how to deal with. And we sort of made it up as we went along. And I can kind of sympathize with my professors back in 1963 for their sort of uncertainty as how to deal with this, because I really wasn't quite sure what to do. And I found myself having to give condolences to the families of the Hobart men who had died on that day. A difficult thing.
Well, I think your historical training has served you well. And don't worry, we do preserve some of those cinder block and fluorescent light fixtures so that we can preserve that era on campus as well. Now, I'm a big fan of...
It's called mid-century modern.
Exactly. We need a little of that too. So I am a big fan of your writing that you post regularly on your Facebook page and your blog, Tales from Hobart and Wayne Smith. And it's a fantastic resource for HWS history. What are some of your favorite bits of lore that you uncovered while researching and writing?
Well, I've done a lot of reading about the colleges. I love the social history. That's what I taught at the Air Force Academy. I also taught military history. I was never trained as a military historian. But one of the things that you find when you teach at a military academy is that you become a military historian, whether you've ever had any training or not. First time I taught military history, I was 2 weeks ahead of the students. And I'm sure that though anyone who's taught in academia probably has found themselves in a situation where they're just barely ahead of their students as to what's going on. But social history really fascinates me. And the big problem that I found with Warren Huntington Smith's book is it's very dry and there's no life in it. There's no sense of what the place was like. So when I got back as the alumni director, I really did a lot of looking into how people lived, how the students lived, and what things were like. And now, in addition to that kind of research that I did earlier, I'm working on a book about veterans and their service and how it ties into their time at the colleges and what it was like for them to go off to war, having been part of the colleges. And so I really started digging into the guys who were in the Civil War. I didn't really know much about them. I found a list of all the men who had served both in the Union and the Southern armies in the Herald, of all things, looking at an old Herald from the era. And also there's a general catalog of the colleges that was published in 1897 that lists every single graduate of the colleges and basically tells whether or not they were in the Army or the Navy during the Civil War. So with that as a research, I began to go through and see what I could find about these. And one of the more interesting guys I found was a man named Benjamin Franklin McReynolds, who was a lieutenant in the Union Army. And he had been in a veterans hospital in Annapolis, Maryland in 1865. He'd had pneumonia and they let him out and he was discharged from the service. So he decided to go down to Washington and go to the theater. I don't know whether you can see where I'm going with this, but he was in Washington in April 1865 and decided to go to Ford's Theater. And he was in the audience the night that Lincoln was assassinated. And I thought, wow, what a thing to be part of. I mean, here's a guy who was in Geneva, New York, suddenly finds himself in the Union Army, goes to the theater and is there at a moment, in a turning point in American history. And I'll tie this to an experience that I had, because I was in Washington, D.C. in 1968 in my first job, which was that dead-end job. And Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in California. And they brought the body back to D.C. by train. And I was down at Union Station with my friend, and we saw them take the body and the motorcade went by where we were standing and headed out toward Arlington. And this was about 10 o'clock at night. We'd been waiting for about 3 hours. Well, the next day, my friend and I decided we'd go over to Arlington Cemetery to pay our respects to John Kennedy's grave and see if we could see where Bobby was buried. So we went over. It was June 9th, 1968. The date's forever in my mind, just as I'm sure that date was forever in the mind of Benjamin Franklin McReynolds. We're up at Kennedy's grave at the Eternal Flame. And you remember, at first, it was kind of a rough area. There was just kind of a small flame, and it was a stone plaza. And we were standing there, and we turned around, and who's coming up the steps behind us but Jacqueline Kennedy and the two children who have come to pay their respects to Bobby Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Well, when we were at the grave, looking at Jack's grave, there was absolutely nobody around. As soon as Jackie started walking up the steps, hundreds of people appeared magically out of nowhere. I don't know where they came from. This huge crowd appeared. She came up, she put flowers at Bobby's grave, and then she walked like a foot in front of me. I actually took some snapshots. I felt kind of guilty taking pictures of her and the children at this, because it was a very private moment, but I thought, oh, well, I might as well get pictures of it because this is the way it is. Those are the kind of things that Hobart and William Smith graduates have sort of found themselves engaged with. And looking at some of these stories, I mean, there are other stories that alums have shared. One alum shared a story with me about working at the Bellhurst in the 1950s in a jazz band, and they were having a gambling operation at the Bellhurst, which was sort of illegal, and he'd play music for it. Other people have talked about working for Saga. A lot of us worked for Saga when we were students. And we put in a full 8-hour day at Saga. Most people didn't realize that. I worked 2.5 hours in the morning. I worked 2 hours at noon. And I worked another 2.5 hours in the evening at the evening meal, in addition to going to classes and doing everything else I did. So it was a big part of our lives to work for Saga. And a lot of people have stories about how tied they were to the colleges through working from Saga, either up on the hill where the women ate in Comstock Dining Room, and they served the women as white gloved waiters, or working out at Houghton House where the senior women lived at that point, and again being a waiter, or just working in Gulick Hall, which was the main dining hall. And I was the head waiter at Gulick on one of the feeding lines because I was pretty good at what I was doing. And so I got to basically know almost every single Hobart man because I saw them every day for the first 2 years when they ate there. So working at Saga, interacting with the faculty, when I was doing my honors work, my advisor was Bob Huff, who's passed away now. And I got to know Bob really well. You get to know your honors advisor pretty well. And Bob was after me for my second chapter of my honors paper, which I was dawdling over, as students tend to do. And I'm sitting in my room one night in Medbury Hall, my senior year, playing bridge with two or three of my friends. And I hear this knock on the door. And I open the door, and it's Bob Huff. And he says, "Ah, Mr. Neuvel, a man's home is no longer his castle." Wanted to know where my honors paper was. So I did complete it. And I didn't tell him that I completed my second chapter while I was in Florida on spring break. And I mailed it to him from Baltimore so that he would get it as far north as I could put it in the mail, so he didn't know that I'd goofed off most of spring break. But I did okay. I graduated with high honors. And I also, you know, you make these lifelong associations. One of my professors, Maynard Smith, just passed away. Maynard was 101.
Wow.
And the thing that most people didn't know about Maynard, he was an emeritus professor of political science. He was a B-29 or B-24 pilot in World War II. Maynard and I used to talk about flying. And I knew him as a student because he was the advisor of Pi Gamma Mu, which was the Social Science Honor Society. So those are the kind of things I've discovered as I've been digging around, and I like to bring to people's attention. And of course, everybody associates with the Twin Oaks. Every time I write about the Twin Oaks,
it gets the biggest, I hear that one all the time.
It gets the biggest reaction.
Well, you are in a unique position in your history with the institution as an alum, a parent, the former alumni director, and the ad hoc HWS historian. And this is our bicentennial year. We're looking back at the college's past and toward our future. What do you see, just in a few words, as the main through lines or defining characteristics of the institution?
I think that if there were one thing that I would say that characterizes Hobart and William Smith, it's a place where you can find yourself, where you can become the person that you want to be, and people will help you become that person. When I came, as I said, I almost didn't make it to the second year, but there were people who guided me and helped me to become the person that I really was meant to be. And I really strongly believe I was meant to be at Hobart. Flyers are very much fatalists. You may have gotten that from my book. You know, every time we went up, we always had this feeling, if the silver bullet's going to get you, the silver bullet's going to get you. Mm. What's meant to be is meant to be. And I really, in my heart, believe I was meant to be at Hobart. Hobart gave me the start for my life. It's like quoting Elizabeth Blackwell, I had found the place I was meant to be. And I think a lot of students felt that way. A lot of my friends had tried to get into the Ivy League schools, and Hobart was their second choice. And they decided in the end that they were where they were meant to be, and was just for a number of reasons. And there were people like John Woody, who I said earlier, who really took an interest in me, and Bob Huff. And if you would go to a bigger school, you probably would have had a close relationship with one professor, but I don't think you would have had the same kind of relationship where you were in their homes and they really just, you almost felt like you were part of their family. And that's the way I've always felt about the colleges.
Well, I'm glad you ended up here too. Partly because you are the one who actually is our ad hoc historian right now. Otherwise, you'd be doing this for some other school. So thank you so much for being with me on the Pulteney Street podcast today, John.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and you've really made my day. Thank you for asking me.